welcome to VBAC Birth Stories. Join us as we speak to Australian women about their journey towards a vaginal birth after cesarean.
In Australia, the cesarean rate has risen to 36%. That's one of the highest rates in the developed world. We hope that by sharing these stories, women and their care providers are able to gain insight into why these rates are on the increase. We also get to meet and understand the women behind these numbers.
We are your hosts, Mel and Steph, and we hope you enjoy Season 3 of VBAC Birth Stories.
Hi everyone, it's Steph here, and in this week's episode, Mel and I would love for you to meet Kate, who is a mum of two living in Darwin. Kate is the daughter of a midwife, so really she had a lot of that insider knowledge on her side going into her first birth. But unfortunately, after she was labouring for a very long time, she was placed on the cesarean pathway. And although there were things about that birth that she would change, she was able to bond with her daughter. She wasn't separated from her baby, and she was able to have that immediate skin-to-skin, which we often hear makes all the difference. In her second birth, you'll hear of how she came very close to a repeat cesarean, but ended up giving birth vaginally to her posterior baby in the operating theatre. Kate's stories are really full of good humour, and she has a great practical approach, a lot of gutsiness and a lot of courage, which I think that's always very inspiring and useful to take into any birth, really. A huge shout out actually this week to our Patreons who have come on board to support the running of our podcast. As you know, the podcast is an independently broadcast show, which Mel and I spend our own time recording and editing, juggling in between work and parenting. So it really does help us to keep going, receiving all of your support, and we are extremely grateful for it. So thank you very much to those people who have come on board. As always, we hope you enjoy this episode.
Thanks, Kate, for joining us today to share your VBAC journey. It's really nice to speak to someone from Darwin. So would you like to just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you for having me. So my name's Kate and I've lived in Darwin for about 15 years, but I'm originally from Perth, West Australia. I'm a teacher and I live with my husband, Matt, and my nearly three-year-old Stella and my eight-month-old Miles.
We haven't actually spoken to anyone from Darwin before or from like the Northern Territory. Did you want to paint a little bit of a picture of what it's like there, what the community's like where you live anyway?
I live right in central Darwin, and I think I've lived in Wagga in New South Wales. It's about the same size as that, and it's a really relaxed like pace of life. Everyone's really relaxed. It's very hot.
Yeah.
We either have hot and dry, which is the dry season at the moment, or we have hot and wet in the wet season where it rains every day, but it's very humid. And the build-up to the wet season is called crazy season or mango madness, where it's really humid and really hot and everyone goes a little bit crazy.
Wow.
So imagine being pregnant.
Yeah, I was just going to say, how does that go in pregnancy when you've got that level of humidity and the heat and all of that? Because
I found it really tough, but I'm not one of those people that's going to say I loved pregnancy. I just found it hot and uncomfortable. And I'm someone that's not pregnant at the front. I get pregnant all over. I just have a round everything, and I found it tough, especially towards the end of my son's pregnancy when I was very pregnant, and it was the hottest time of the year.
Did you want to take us to before you fell pregnant with your first? Did you have any plans for that or any ideas about how you might like to give birth, anything like that?
Yeah, so my mum's actually a midwife and a nurse. So she had three kids. I've got two brothers, and she had us all naturally. And I'm quite a determined person, and I usually do things I set my mind to. So, of course, I was going to have a natural birth because, you know, that's what I wanted. And I was in my 30s and I'd had quite a few friends that had had issues with fertility. So I was a little bit concerned, but I'd started tracking my ovulation. I was actually bridesmaid at my best friend's wedding. And after a few champagnes, I said, I'm ovulating tonight. I'm going to make a baby, everyone. That's how my daughter came to be.
Wow.
The first night I ovulated. And, yeah, I got pregnant with my daughter first go. And I remember I knew it had happened. So I remember taking a pregnancy test and my husband says, it doesn't happen the first time, Kate. And then he saw the two little lines. I said, yes, it does.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of thought, well, if that can happen, of course I'm going to have the birth I want. I had quite a good pregnancy in terms of I wasn't too sick. I was a little bit nauseous, but, you know, nothing too bad. I'm working full time and very active right up to 40 weeks. I swam and I did yoga. But about 30 weeks, I started to get carpal tunnel quite badly and suffered. That was actually really uncomfortable.
Was that in your hands?
Yeah, in both hands.
Yes.
It's like a numbness that travels from, I guess, your elbow all the way up to your hand. And as it got worse, it's just to do with swelling. But it's quite strange because you can't actually, you look at your arm and it looks normal. But the feeling, I feel sorry for anyone that's got it full time because it's really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And because I'm a teacher and I was trying to do things with the kids like cutting, I actually didn't have feeling in my hands. Because you lose, like even just picking things up becomes quite difficult. You lose a lot of your dexterity. I went to a hand therapist and got some splints made because it's also the worst for sleeping because you can't sleep because that's when you kind of put your arms in strange positions and you wake up and your hands are just burning. Mm. And in pregnancy, there's not any medication or anything you can take, obviously. I guess that was part of my swelling. My blood pressure started to creep up and up and up. I think I was diagnosed with high blood pressure around 38 weeks and they started really monitoring me for that.
How are you feeling in that time? Did it cause you to question your abilities to birth naturally or did you not have any concerns at this point?
I think I was a bit worried because of the high blood pressure, I wasn't able to have I wanted to go in the birth suite, which is a natural delivery, but because I'd have to be on monitoring, I wasn't able to do that. They started to talk about juicing me because of the high blood pressure and, you know.
Is it a birth centre? Is that what you?
Just to paint the picture, in Darwin you've got a lot less choice than you would anywhere else. So there's a public hospital and there's a private hospital. So there's only two choices. I do have private cover, but anecdotally in Darwin there's a lot more chance of having a cesarean if you go private. Mm. It's just kind of a known thing, even that you talk to midwives and they go, well, you'll end up with a Caesar if you're with Dr. so-and-so, because there's only two obstetricians and, you know, there's a lot of women and they kind of will schedule you in to fit what fits with them. Like I was talking to someone the other day, someone who did want a VBAC, they went in for their first 12-week appointment or three-month appointment. The doctor opened the diary and said, okay, we'll schedule you in for this date. Several people I've talked to have had a similar experience. So that was my choice to go public. Also, I did want to go through the midwife program that's available up here, which isn't what I've heard on your podcast that talking about the continuum of care. Say midwife, we don't have that up here. It's kind of like you just see whatever midwife is on duty. And they do quite often change their models, but with my daughter, it was you're on the pink team, which is sort of the one close to you, and that's where you have your appointments with the midwife. And if there's any issues and later on in your pregnancy, then you go into the hospital and you might see some obstetricians then.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So it was good because throughout most of my pregnancy, I just saw the midwives and I found the midwives amazing. I also had a student midwife follow me through my journey. So she was great. She attended all my appointments as well.
Take us towards the end then. What happened after you were, I guess, sort of diagnosed with sort of high blood pressure?
They just were monitoring me closely and I had to have more appointments at the hospital. And my mum said, don't let them induce you. You know, and this is, she's just talking to your midwife, don't let them induce me. So I only knew what my mum said. My mum lives in Perth, so she was far away from me, but she's just on the phone saying, don't let. So if I hadn't have known, I probably would have just let them induce me. But she said, ask for a stretch and sweep. And I didn't know what that was, but I said, I sure enough went to my appointment and said, can I have a stretch and sweep? So I had one on the Friday, and then I had another appointment booked on the Monday. And I think I had a little bit of slight bleeding. It was a bit uncomfortable, but sort of nothing had happened over the weekend. And on the Monday, I asked for another one, and my mum said on the phone, make sure you ask for a vigorous one. So I said to the doctor, can I use a really vigorous one? And that one was actually a bit more painful, but that was on the Monday. And I went home, and I was actually, it's quite funny, I was actually lazing around in the pool on my noodle, wailing around. It was just a huge wail. And I said to my husband, oh, I think my water's just broke, because I was in the noodle in the pool and I felt this kind of release.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, get out the pool. So I was trying to get out the pool, hold in everything. And, yeah, that was my water. So it happened spontaneously with the help of the stretch and switch. As they do, I follow their instructions, ring the hospital, and the hospital's about half an hour away from where I was living then. And they said, come in. So that was about 5 p.m. on the Monday, so I had to go into hospital, but nothing was really happening. That my husband's like, oh, I thought everything was going to be so rushed, because on the way there, I'm like, we might as well stop for dinner. And we sort of had the bags packed and everything, because I was nearly 40 weeks. You know, we just stopped for dinner. It was quite leisurely. We drove into the hospital, walked up, and they said, had a look and said, yeah, your waters have gone. Nothing else is happening. Here's 2 sleeping tablets. Go home and sleep. Which in hindsight I find ridiculous, because I'd started, you know, things had started moving as if I was going to go home to sleep, but I took them because that's what they told me to do. Didn't do anything because I was in labour. So I laboured through at home through that night. I was in the shower a lot. I had a lot of back pain. Kept waking my husband up. Okay, time my contractions now. No, still not close enough together. Okay, time them now, because I was quite uncomfortable. Not really bad, but quite uncomfortable. Sort of definitely couldn't sleep. And then by about 8 a.m. the next morning, I said, no, I don't care how far apart they are. I'm too uncomfortable. We're going. So we went into hospital, and sort of it was quite busy. Don't have a September baby, because they're all the Christmas sections. So
yes.
They were quite busy in the hospital. They didn't have a room, so they had to sort of wait till someone else vacate. And I got in eventually, and I don't remember how dilated I was, but it wasn't very far along. So they just sort of had left me to it, and I was just labouring. I know that things were going quite slowly. So it was 8 o'clock in the morning by the time when I got in. And at 11, they had put the drip in, because it had been a long time since my waters had gone, which also, and they wanted me on the monitoring the whole time due to the high blood pressure. So I really wanted to be in the shower, but they had the cordless monitoring that kept going flat. So that made it really difficult, because I wasn't able to be in the shower, which was where I was most comfortable. I also had lots and lots of waters. Every contraction, I had all these waters, and I was quite nauseous. I was dry reaching a lot. I remember them during my labour bringing in full plates of food, and I just looked at it like, am I going to eat a roast dinner right now? I'm like, are they for real?
That's interesting.
Yes, I was there so long, they just needed to keep me fed. But I certainly wasn't eating. I was very nauseous. I was really uncomfortable, but not to the point of, like, my plan was, let's go as naturally and drug-free as possible. I was managing on that. I did have some gas, but I think that might have been what was making me nauseous.
Ooh.
And I could not stand to sit or lie, I think, because now that I know, because my baby was posterior, no one told me anything. I didn't even know the word posterior in my first birth. But, yeah, I could not sit. I was on the ball, or I was on the head of the bed sort of sitting up. I was really uncomfortable. And when they went, every time they wanted to examine me, they made me lie down, and that was excruciating, just the pressure on my back. Everything was going quite slowly. I think I was only 3 or 4 centimetres. So then they talked about giving me some oxytocin to try and speed things up a little bit. And because I'd been there nearly, that was about 5 o'clock in the evening, so I'd been there all day with not a lot, I agreed to that.
Because your mum was a midwife, was she coming as a support person, or no, you didn't talk about that
because
at all?
She knows a bit too much. I think she kind of offered to be there. I think it would have been quite difficult having her there, because she actually offered to come once Bub was born.
Yeah.
I think she just wanted to keep that little bit of distance, but it also made it hard because she kind of knew what was going on but didn't really. So she'd make comments like, oh, you were sitting down too much in your labour. And it was like, I actually couldn't sit down.
Yeah.
But my husband, with every kind of sort of obstacle we hit, he'd ring her and say that they're saying this now, should we do this? And she'd say, yeah, do that. Because they always did ask, but you're not in the position to say no, I don't feel, because, I don't know, you're just at the whim of what they are suggesting. If they're saying that's the best course, then I was in the position that, okay, they're saying that's what I need to do, then I'm going to do it. I guess now, second time around, you know a bit more about questioning things and taking back a bit of that power. But I felt in the first one, and also because I was so sick, like nausea, I just wasn't in a good headspace to make decisions. Like, it was all just a blur. I was just in my own world. Really felt like I was just in the zone going through it, and it'd been all day. And they only check you every 3 hours. So I'd be like, is it 3 hours yet? I don't want to know how many centimetres I am, which I found it quite funny when I hear some of the ladies in your podcast saying they don't want to know. I was the opposite. I was like, come on, tell me. I want to know now. And it was another 3 hours till they'd check, and it'd be, you know, one more centimetre. And I'd be like, oh, it's got to be more. It's got to be more. So once they turned on the oxytocin, things had started moving a little bit quicker. I'd started to get a bit pushy. So they were saying, like, I think it's because she was right in my back. So I'd started pushing, and then they're like, you need to stop pushing. Your cervix is getting quite swollen. And if once it gets swollen, then, you know, that can really hold things up. They said, why don't you have some morphine just to give you, you can have that, and then maybe you can have a bit of a rest. And by that stage, even though I was like, I don't want to do drug free, you know, call mum. Yeah, you should do it. Yeah, have a break. You should have a break. So I had the morphine, and it did stop the swelling. But the oxytocin had sort of stopped really working. And I remember they kept on turning it up, and they actually rang, the person who was doing it actually rang someone else and said, can I keep turning this up? So they were getting permission. So it was obviously kind of on the highest setting allowable.
Yeah.
And they did the 3 hourly check. I was 5 to 6, and then another 3 hours, and I was still 6. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of by midnight the next night. So I'd come in on the Tuesday morning, that was sort of Tuesday midnight, and they said, look, it's nothing's happening, sort of.
So you had like an induction drip by the sounds of it, and they were turning it up, and you're feeling artificial contractions still, or natural?
It's a good question. I think the feeling was still the same that I'd had throughout the whole labour, so I guess it was natural. I just feel like my body didn't really respond to that drug as much. It wasn't like it suddenly just became really intense or anything. It sped them up a bit, and then they kind of dulled back down, and nothing was really happening.
At this point, they didn't know that baby was posterior either.
Well, they might have known, but they never told me. Like, I don't feel like that communication was there. No one ever told me why, like, it was taking so long. So I didn't know. I just was going through. I was in my zone. I was just going through the labour as best I could. I really wanted that outcome. I didn't want to go to surgery. I wanted to keep going. I was managing. I was actually managing the pain okay with the gas, and the morphine helped, but nothing was really happening. We weren't progressing. That lovely term, failure to progress. Ooh. So that's at 6 to 7. I was just exhausted by that stage because I'd been on my feet that whole labour. So that's when they said, look, you're going to have to go to a caesarean. And it was funny because we'd have that many shift changes, different nurses. I had one of the nurses, oh, you're still here. Oh, thanks, you know, because it had been so long. I had my student midwife there, but she'd actually done a whole shift and had to leave, so she'd missed the caesarean, which was a shame. Clocked over midnight on the Wednesday, and that was my daughter's due date. So me and my husband just looked at each other and went, oh, she's going to be born on her due date. So she was never in distress. That's another reason I was happy just to keep going as long as I could, because the monitoring was on and she was happy in there. There was, you know, no signs of distress or anything like that. They did say, look, it's time to do the caesarean around midnight, I think, yeah.
Were you distressed by that stage, or were you just exhausted?
I was exhausted, and I'm just in tears, and just I remember looking at my husband and saying, I just can't do it anymore. I don't have anything left. You know, I've been awake for over 24 hours, quite sick. Yeah. I think I tried my best. I can't do anything. So we went down to theatre. She was born about 4 a.m. But absolute worst part of that whole thing, like, I didn't find that, it was hard, but it wasn't really painful. I was in the zone. is when I went down and they tried to get the spinal in, they couldn't get it in. So they were up, and my husband was really traumatized by this too, because they, what they did is that they said to him, okay, we're just going to go prepare her, it'll be about 10 minutes and then we'll call you in. So they wheeled me in, prepared me, but they, that was when they were trying to get the spinal in, and he just couldn't get it. And all, I just felt these shooting pains right down my legs as he was trying to insert it, and I was screaming in pain. So my husband's outside hearing me scream in agony, not knowing what's going on. It was over an hour that they tried. I was in the zone. I didn't know what was going on, but he said it was an over an hour. He was out there waiting, hearing me in agony. It was awful. So that must have been a junior anaesthetist. So they ended up calling in the senior anaesthetist, who got it in first go. It was awful, the pain of them trying to insert that spinal. Oh, and, you know, they're telling you, bend over more, and you've got this huge round belly that you're trying to bend over and stay still. Luckily, I didn't have a lot of contractions, so I, once they turned off the oxytocin, they seemed to really die down. So I didn't have to stay still through the pain of the contraction, but it was awful. I was quite traumatised by that.
Do you think that was a lack of training on their behalf? Or
In hindsight, maybe, because I remember afterwards I had a reaction to whatever they'd put on. My skin was really itchy. Whatever they'd put on around the spinal had just come up in welts. And I remember the midwife having a look, and she said, oh, and then I told her what had happened, and she said, do you want to I don't remember. She said feedback form or something, you know, suggesting maybe I should write that. But by then I had my baby and she was well, and I was like, oh, no, it's fine. You know, I've got my baby. I had all those good hormones. And then for my next pregnancy, I did actually write, I would like a senior anaesthetist if it comes to that due to the difficulties with my last spinal.
How was the surgery itself? And were you able to have immediate skin to skin with
your
daughter?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I had asked for. And I knew to ask for, and as soon as she came out, I didn't actually find the surgery. It was very quick once the spinal was in, and she came out and she was right on my chest, came out crying. And as soon as I saw her, I forgot the birth. It was like as soon as I met her, I was like, oh, she's here. And as soon as she was on my chest, she didn't go anywhere. She was healthy, so I got to keep her the whole time, and I'm so thankful for that. Wow. Because that was the best thing. Like, I got time with her in recovery. I think they just took her off to weigh her, and then she was straight back on. As soon as I saw her, I was like, oh, I'm fine now. what all that happened? Yeah. Later on, I had a bit of time to process and thought maybe that wasn't really good. But I was sad to have not got my vaginal birth, but I had a healthy baby. So I was like, she's beautiful, and I just had all those good hormones, and it was amazing.
That's great.
How was your breastfeeding experience?
I actually had a lot of trouble initially breastfeeding. My milk was really late to come in, I think, because I also had about 1.2 litres of blood loss through my cesarean. And because I had such a long labour, then I had the cesarean, I was actually like I was hit by a truck. I was drugged up, I was sore, and I can't believe they let me take care of a baby. I was so drugged up and I had no idea what was going on. Because I was public, my husband had to go home, so he didn't get to stay with me. Like, he stayed a little bit and then had to go home. And I've got this brand new baby and I didn't know what was going on, but I think she actually slept a lot more after the birth too. I think both of us were recovering from that huge marathon. And, yeah, I feel like up here they're very quick to push formula. My milk was late to come in. They knew I had blood loss. They knew all these things, and she had dropped 10% of her body weight. So then they're like, you have to top up with formula. Ooh. And it wasn't Q ringing my mum. They're telling me I have to top up. She's like, ask them to do a sideline feeding. And I didn't, like, if I didn't have her, they didn't offer that to me. So then I had to say, can I please have the sideline feeding? If you don't know what that is, it's basically, they have a little tube and the baby is still feeding off your nipple, but you're supplementing it with formula or express milk. It turned out she had quite a bad tongue tie, so my nipples were all grazed. And so the combination of milk late coming in, tongue tie, wasn't very good. But
did they pick up on the tongue tie immediately?
Yeah. Oh, I did see the lactation consultant. And she was really good, and she talked about the tongue tie and recommended a dentist, a local dentist in town that actually lasered them. But the problem was, and it's happened with my son as well, they're not feeding, they're not getting enough. The doctors are looking at the percentages of weight loss, but until you discharge, you're not able to see the dentist to get the tongue tie revised. So they weren't letting me discharge. I was exhausted because you cannot sleep in the public hospital. Our hospital doesn't have doors, and they're shared rooms, so they're all curtains. So it's just so noisy. You just can't get any sleep. And then I had that day three or the day four, what do they call it? The blues, the baby blues, when all yes. your hormones come.
Yeah.
And I remember them telling me, I just want to go home. And they wouldn't let me home. And I was just sobbing to my husband, I just want to go home, because they kept on weighing her. And they said, oh, she's not up enough. But they wouldn't let me until she reached that point. So I feel bad now, but they just pump them with formula until they get to that magic number. And then they send you off. But I was still expressing, and I just didn't have enough milk yet. Mm. I don't think until I got home, I relaxed and was in my environment that my milk had really come in properly. And then as soon as we saw the dentist, got the tongue tie revised, we never looked back. Wow. It was like magic. I fed her until I was half 6 months pregnant and had to pry her off the breast because I had really bad aversions. But she was nearly two.
Wow.
18 months. She just fed really well after that. So the dentist was amazing. And the recovery was instant because they laser it. It was fantastic. Best thing. Because I've heard some people get them snipped, but then they can grow back. But the laser works really well.
Oh, that's good. Interesting. Was it they were able to identify that was causing the issues with breastfeeding?
But it was funny to me because even they knew that was an issue, they still were really concerned about the weight. It's a circle.
Until you resolve that, then they're not able to feed adequately enough. Yeah. So then how did that postpartum period go once you got home? Obviously breastfeeding improved a lot.
So it was kind of two weeks or 3 weeks until I really had established breastfeeding well and stopped the top-ups and everything. And then I had family come and stay, and I found physically I got hit by a truck. It took me a long time physically to be moving around comfortably, but not too bad. It just took me quite a while to get back into exercise and things like that.
Ooh.
But I was just so in love with my baby. I was happy. And being a teacher, I was like, oh, I don't really like little kids. I can do them once they talk. I don't know how I'm going to go. And everyone's like, oh, it's different with your own. I thought, oh, but it really is different with your own. Everything they do, you're like, oh, that's so amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. It sounded like you bonded quite well, despite the cesarean, and there wasn't a lot of separation there, and you bonded.
I think that skin on skin and having your baby the whole time really makes such a difference. Since then, I've been a clingy parent and had trouble letting go.
Yeah. That's a nice thing.
Yeah.
Did your hospital tell you anything about recommendations for future pregnancies?
Oh, I do remember, and it was quite soon after the birth, and I was lying in a bed, drugged up to anything, and I remember the doctor saying to me, there's no reason you can't go for a vaginal birth next time. I wouldn't blame you if you didn't want to, but there's no reason you can't. And I thought, okay, and I remember her saying that, so I thought I clung on to that thought, and then I knew that's what I wanted. Because it hadn't worked out the way that I wanted.
So you knew pretty early on.
I knew straight away.
You knew straight away, yeah. So tell us what it was like when you fell pregnant again, and and how were you feeling about this pregnancy?
So I knew I wanted a 2-year gap between my kids, but because I was still breastfeeding, I wasn't really ovulating, so it's a bit hard to track my periods. It was only on my second period, and I knew that I was pregnant again straight away, and I took the test before my period was due, because I just knew. And I think my period was due on a Monday, and I took the test on a Friday and I was pregnant. Wow. So, yeah, my kids are 2 years, 2 months. So not quite 2 years, but yeah. So I'm very, very blessed in that regard. And straight away, it's quite funny, I knew the pregnancy felt different. So I'm like, I think it's a boy. And we never found out with both of our kids what we were having, but I just felt different. And I thought, oh, maybe you might feel different every pregnancy. I don't know, but it's only ever my second pregnancy. But, yeah, sure enough, it turned out to be a boy. And I was I had an even better pregnancy. I was less sick. Not that I was that sick first time. I didn't get the carpal tunnel, which I was really nervous about, which is strange, but maybe that's to do with the high blood pressure, the swelling. I don't know. But I didn't have the carpal tunnel, which I was worried about dealing with a toddler. I was working full time and with a toddler. So I didn't have a lot of time. I did lots of spinning babies, yoga, and I swam right up to 40 weeks with Stella, but I just didn't have time with this one. I was physically active running around with the toddler, but I didn't have time to do a lot of the things that I did with my first. Ooh. But it was, it was quite I didn't have the high blood pressure either.
Did you go through the same model of care, so the same public hospital? Okay.
Yes. So I went, well, what were my other choices really up here? It was like, well, you know, maybe if I had were somewhere else, I had a bit more choices, I might have made a different decision. But no, I went through the same midwife program. Initially with Stella, I wanted what they have here, a birth suite. So down the bottom of the hospital, I think it's only 4 or 5 rooms, and they've got a bar and things like that. But you have to be like the perfect pregnant woman, no high blood pressure,
no risk.
Yeah. So of course, they weren't going to touch me. Second time around, I didn't get in for the first one, and I hear it's rare as hen's teeth to actually birth down there. I think it's a lot of empty rooms a lot of the times, because as soon as anything is wrong, they put you upstairs.
Yeah, that sounds like the equivalent to what we have here, which are the birthing centres at some hospitals. So very low-risk pregnancies, and, most of the time, well, as I did, got shafted down the corridor into the labour ward. I was going to ask you, at this point, had anyone spoken to you about the possibility of a VBAC, or had any of these discussions taken place?
I remember talking to my mum about having it, and she said, well, if you go to an obstetrician, they're going to look at your notes and not touch you. And I actually have an uncle who's an obstetrician, and he said that, well, you're going to have another cesarean. He's an old guy, but there's no chance of you you might die type thing.
Really? What was the reasoning for that?
Because of the blood loss, the obstructed labour, it's just going to happen again, I'm quite small, like I'm 5'5"-ish, if that, and my husband's quite tall. Mm. So although my daughter was 3'4".
Yeah.
Right, so she's just
average size.
But that was his, you're just going to have big babies. And actually I did pop out quite early with my son. It was second pregnancy, but they were a bit worried that he was measuring big from the start. So that was a bit of a worry. But I always knew that I wanted a VBAC. I remember my husband said, 3-month appointment, I said, oh, well, I'll be having a VBAC. And my husband said, I remember you telling me that. And I was sitting in the car and I was shocked, because the first experience had been so full on. He's like, why would you do that again? But he didn't tell me that. To his credit, he said, okay, if that's what you want, go for it. But he said, I remember internally, I was like, what is she thinking? I really wanted that experience. I don't know what it is about women. We just want that experience to see what it feels like and what it's like.
So the hospital staff themselves, like in this pregnancy, they were quite supportive of your intention to be back?
I would say the midwives are very supportive, and it was awesome, because my first appointment with the midwife at the hospital ended up being my student midwife from my last pregnancy. So I saw her and went, oh, she's like, you're back. So that was really nice. She knew my history. I feel like a lot of the doctors would say she wants a VBAC with an eye roll type thing. It felt like it was very pie in the sky. I just didn't feel like that, that's what she wants. Let's just humour her type thing, And, of course, all the appointments, they're first to tell you about all the risks and things like that. And I remember I had one particular appointment about 34 weeks where I had a young female gynecologist, or is it obstetrician? I'm not sure. Obstetrician? Mm. Doctor. Mm. who had gone through all the risks, like I'd already been told of all the risks, you'd gone through it all, and what happens, and I said, I don't want to get induced. Well, what happens if, you get to this amount of time? And I was like, we're talking 5-6 weeks. Why are we talking about? And I remember feeling really annoyed, but I walked away from that appointment thinking, why did she tell me all the negatives? At the moment, I have nothing against, I wasn't high risk. There was nothing wrong. I was measuring a little bit big, but by that stage I'd kind of evened out. and they wanted a late scan. So I had a late scan and it said, yeah, he was at an average size. It's just because I'm small, I kind of get really big. But I remember walking away. Of course, I rang my mum again. Mum, just had this really bad appointment with this doctor. She said, oh, just don't listen to her. But I just remember feeling really like she was not on my team. And I thought, oh, why didn't I say, you know, when you walk away from home, why didn't I say that? Why didn't she tell me any of the risks of a cesarean? They never talk about that.
Did you?
It's a major surgery. They never tell you.
Kate, I'm just curious. So you listen to the podcast?
Yes, religiously.
Did you like when you were having these appointments? Was that around the same time? And did you draw on those experiences? Because I know there's a lot of women who have had similar experiences to you that we speak to. Yeah.
But I think in the heat of the moment, you don't think about. Yeah. But I knew from the podcast, I knew to stand my ground about wanting a VBAC. I knew about the statistics on the uterine rupture. were actually very small. And I guess I knew enough to know what I wanted and be strong in that. But still, to have your doctor question it and say, well, and I knew I didn't want an induction because I knew that reduced the risk, but they still push for the induction. You know, what if you get past this point? I just felt, and I love the episode you did with the researcher, the midwife who was a researcher, and I really got a lot out of that one.
Yeah.
Hazel Keedle.
Yeah, she was great.
That's good that you were able to draw on that and know that, you know, you weren't alone in this.
Yes.
There are women out there going through the same thing that you're going through.
Why is it still like this, you know?
They need to listen to the podcast, all of them. Get all the obstetricians on board.
And because every time I see someone in the public, it's always a different doctor, your response is different depending on what their views are. Yeah. Interestingly, the older male doctors, in my experience, seem to be far more on board and comfortable. The younger female doctor that I had was not.
And maybe that indicates, or that points towards, the culture of risk aversion and avoiding litigation and all of that. Yeah. So that has actually been on the increase. And so, it's sort of just about balancing that risk, I guess, and, informing yourself about it. Yeah.
So my dad had come up from Perth to help with the toddler for this birth because we needed someone at home to have the toddler. So, but he had come up a bit early. He ended up coming up in September and I wasn't due till the 21st of November. I thought, oh, Dad, you're here for a while. And, of course, he doesn't do well in the heat and it was really hot and then all the issues with COVID had happened. So he was afraid of getting locked out of WA. So he ended up leaving a week before I gave birth. So that was really stressful because I thought, okay, don't even worry. At least you've got someone to look after the child. And then he had to leave to get back so he wasn't locked out. And then we thought, oh, we had to scramble to try and find someone to have my daughter, like friends, the plan A, plan B, plan C. And that was when I was due. So he ended up being a week overdue. And then I had the stress of, I want this baby to come. I don't want it to get induced. Now my dad's left. And I feel like that was really quite stressful and probably stopped that natural things happening. But I did know enough from you guys. I got acupuncture, I had massage and did everything I could to try and keep baby in the right positions because I really wanted to avoid a posterior baby. I had a stretch and sweep and then I went back and asked for another one. And interestingly, the doctor I got on that day said, oh, I don't want to do another one. It might increase your risk of infection. So I went away from that appointment a bit like, oh, come on, I really want to do everything I can to get this baby moving because I was at 40 weeks and they booked me in for an induction the next week. So if anything hadn't happened at 41 weeks, I was getting induced. So then I went back again and the next doctor I for some monitoring because I thought I had a little bit of reduced movements. Funny because as soon as I got on the monitor, the baby wouldn't stop moving. And then I had to stay there for ages for it to stop moving enough for them to see the baseline. But when she was there, she's like, oh, do you want a stretch and sweep? And I said, oh, the other doctor told me that they wouldn't. She's like, I'll do it for you. So luckily she gave me another one. And then I remember I went to sleep on the Saturday night and I remember contractions must have started in my sleep because I started feeling like waves rolling, but I was asleep. But then my daughter woke up. So I went in to settle her And I'm like, yeah, things are really moving here. I went to the toilet during the night, but I don't turn the light on. I just got to go. So I think that's when I lost my plug. Things had started moving. And once it was about 3 o'clock, she woke up. And once I settled her back down, I was like, yep, things are really moving. So then I sort of got up and did weird things, like started washing the dishes and putting away laundry and getting everything ready. I was like, what am I doing now? But it was quite manageable. And I knew from you guys and from the research I'd done, stay at home as long as you can. Oh, and I forgot to mention, they actually offered a VBAC education class through the public hospital, which is awesome, just with one midwife. It ended up being with one midwife and another couple, and myself and my husband, and that was amazing. It was like 4 hours, and she was totally like, the language that she used was so positive. This will happen, and you will do this. And she was just really positive and pro VBAC, and that was great. And that was just great for my husband to hear too, because he kind of was still a little bit like, why are you doing this to yourself?
That's great. So
the whole posterior positioning, why baby probably wasn't, you know, getting in the right position to open up the cervix, everything. It was really good.
What was the key focus of that course? Was it a one-off sort of information
to discuss your experiences, questions, and just talk about the process of a VBAC, that she kind of had said lots of things like, they'll want to monitor you, but you can question that, you know. You don't, you know, when you ring up, they'll tell you to go in once your waters have broken, but you don't have to. You know, she was great. Yeah, so she said a lot of things that aligned with what you guys were saying on your podcast. So that was really good. So I knew enough, you know, to stay home as long as you can. So that was my big key. So 7 a.m., my husband goes to park run. He's like, should I go to park run? I said, yeah, go off to park run. You know, I knew I was in for a long one. Off you go to park run. He's like, are you sure? By the time he came back, I was like, okay, you better do something. So he had to take my daughter to our friend's house, which is about an hour round trip. Ooh. So he went, because my daughter's like, oh, are you okay, mummy? Yeah, it's okay, baby's coming. Because we've been waiting, we're 41 weeks at this stage, so we've been waiting. Yeah, it's time now, you're going to go to your friends, and next time I see you, you know, you're going to have a little baby. And she always wanted a girl, she'd ordered a girl, so I remember her being in tears. It doesn't have a baby. She wanted a sister. It's a girl. Yeah, so that was nice because she was able to see and understand what was going on, and we took but by the time he was halfway to see my friend, things were getting quite intense, and I was like, oh my goodness. And he's bringing me up, have you timed your contractions? I'm like, I cannot time my contractions. How am I going to time my contractions? Now I'm in and out of the shower naked and on the ball and walking around. I was like, I'm not in the position to time the contractions. So I actually rang a friend who I've got around the corner. I said, can you just come around just in case, like anything, because it was quite intense. And they were coming quite high. And she came and timed them and said, okay, you're having 3 in 10. You need to go to the hospital. She rang the hospital only then. It was about 9 a.m. And they're like, yes, bring her in straight away. So as soon as my husband came home, I had to struggle to get some clothes on. And he's like, sit in your seat. And I'm like, I can't sit in my seat. So I was huddling the headrest all the way to the hospital, every bump. I was like, ah! you can't do this. I was like, and then luckily it was a Saturday, so it wasn't busy at the hospital, because they're asking us the COVID questions and taking our temperature, and I'm sort of wailing in the corner and does she need a wheelchair? Does she need a wheelchair? My husband's like, she doesn't need a wheelchair, because I could not sit. I had to be moving, and I knew that it's good to keep moving. But, yeah, I was quite vocal, how embarrassing in hindsight on the way in. Sort of stopping through and having to stop and breathe through every contraction and then keep walking. And they actually heard me in the hallway and all rushed out, or the midwives rushed out and got me in a room. So I remember them checking me and I was 7 centimetres.
Oh, wow.
Which was really exciting, because that's more than like what I got to my daughter. I was 7 centimetres by the time I got there, and that was at 10 a.m. And I remember the midwife saying, you might have this baby by lunchtime. But alas, it was another posterior baby. So I did not have the baby by lunchtime. Things sort of started slowing down. I remember when I got in, I was writhing. I was in a lot of pain. They wanted to put the drip in straight away. And the younger nurse had tried to put it in, but I couldn't sit still. And then I was bleeding everywhere and it was a bit traumatic. So an older midwife came in and managed to get the drip in.
And why were they putting a drip in again?
Because it's a VBAC. That's right. Just their policy.
Do you mean just the cannula?
Yeah, that one. Sorry. Yeah, the cannula. Yeah.
In case you had to be taken to theatre. Yeah, right. And were you happy with them doing that? Like you consented to this?
Or? I consented to it, yeah. I was, it was painful when it was getting in, but I thought, oh, let's fight about other things, not that.
Yes. You know? Yeah. Picking your battles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I was just feeling so much pressure and I was starting to get pushy again. And I thought, oh no, this is happening. And they said, oh, look, you mean I was struggling through every contraction. They were intense and I was really getting quite pushy through each contraction. And they said, look, you're starting to get swollen again. And we talk about birth plans for this. Birth plan, my plan was not to have a plan in terms of don't say I want it drug free. My plan was I will do anything to achieve my VBAC. So if last time I was like, I don't want an epidural, I don't want this, I don't want that, and I got it all. So this time I was like, okay, just say anything that's going to help me achieve that goal, I'll do. So then I was like, all right, let's try the epidural on you. And it's kind of hard because you know everything that you read, stay active, stay on your feet, you know. But they were really intense contractions and I could not help but push. Everyone that came, I was pushing. And once it gets swollen, you know, that's going to impede. So I agreed to that. However, there must be something happening with my spine because the anaesthetist came and it wasn't the senior that I had requested. It was whoever was on duty, which is fair enough. It's a public hospital. She could not get in my epidural. So up and down my spine through massive contractions. They're trying and it wasn't as painful as the spinal, but it was really painful. Like they just could not find a place. So then she had to call someone else and it ended up being about an hour. They got it in, but only impartial block. So I could still feel every contraction, still had to breathe heavily through every contraction, but it stopped me pushing. So it stopped me needing, it let my cervix go back and wasn't swollen anymore. So in hindsight, that was a good call for me because I think if I had said no, we would have ended up at the same position I was with my daughter.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard that actually, like women have said that on the podcast, it's helped to relax them, you know, in order to progress.
But I did have later on, the doctor came back in and said, she shouldn't need to be breathing this hard to reach epidural. Like it's not working. So they rang and got it topped up. And I remember the anaesthetist saying, I'll see her down in theatre later. And I said to my husband, well, he doesn't think I'm going to be able to do this. And that was really
off-putting.
Yeah, why would you say that? Like, I think he meant it like a joke. And then when I was wheeled down to theatre later, he said to me, oh, I guess you didn't want to see me here. And I just thought.
So what ended up happening?
At that stage that I had the epidural, things were moving along. I was breathing through every contraction, but I was opening up. And then about 11 p.m., no, it must be about 5 p.m., I was 8 to 9 centimetres. And who walks in but that horrible young female doctor that I had had that bad experience with. And I just looked at her and I said, I looked at my husband and I said, that's the one I was telling you about. And she said, look, things really aren't progressing. You're going to need a cesarean. And earlier than that, they came in and they did a scan just to check why things were taking so long. The second stage was taking so long. And they said it's posterior. And I bawled. My husband cried. I was like, no, not again. You know, this is why it's taking so long. But at least they said it. And my midwife was amazing. She looked at me and she said, posterior babies are born vaginally every day. She's like, it just takes a bit longer. She's like, that doesn't mean that you're going to need a cesarean.
It's important for them to recognise that the baby is posterior because then you can shift and move to these positions where they can be born vaginally.
Yeah.
It's not an impossibility and you're aware.
I had the epi.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't working that well, I could still move my legs. I guess their policy is once you've had it, you're not allowed to move around just in case anything happens. Yeah, so she was the one that had checked it was posterior. She came back later and said, no, I don't think we can do this. And here is where I'm just lucky. And if I hadn't have had this doctor, it wouldn't have happened. So the head of OBGYN was on duty, and he came and referred and must have read my birth notes of how strongly I wanted a VBAC. He reviewed my case and came in and said, look, I think we can get you there. He's like, you're 8 to 9 centimetres. He said, I think we should put on the oxytocin, speed things up a bit, give you an hour, see what happens. And I was worried about the oxytocin because I knew, but I said to, you know, you knew that it increases your risk of rupture. But I looked at my husband and I said, they're risk adverse. If they thought it was an issue, they wouldn't offer it, you know. And this is where I was a lot more aware of this. I guess I was a lot more mentally aware of what was going on in this throughout this labour as well. Because I think in my first, I wouldn't have been able to even sort of put those thoughts together. So I said, yeah, let's do it. My husband was a bit worried about that because of the risks. But I said, no, let's do it. Let's give it. He just said, give it an hour, see what happens. So we put the oxytocin in for an hour. And I was also a bit like, well, it didn't work last time, so why is it going to work this time? And I'm like, oh, well, what can it hurt? Another hour. And then I got to 10 centimetres. So then he's like, great, you can start pushing. But by then my contractions had kind of slowed a bit. So I was pushing, but I didn't have a lot to push with. Even with the oxytocin, things had sort of started to slow down. So the doctor came back and said, look, 10 centimetres. I want to take you down to theatre just in case. You're going to need some help here. Get the forceps, but if anything goes wrong, it's going to go to a cesarean. So that's how close I came. So we went down to theatre, and when I got down to theatre, the anaesthetist says, okay, you're going to need another spinal. And I was like, no. I remember crying again. I don't want a spinal because of all the issues I had last time with the spinal. I was in tears. Please, not another spinal. And then again, the obstetrician came out and said, no, she's not having a spinal because she won't be able to push then. Wheel her in. So every bit of the way, he kind of overrode those decisions.
Wow.
To enable me to get there. So we went in, and it was pretty excruciating when he put the forceps in and told me to push. Like, it was quite brutal because, it's just very full on.
Were you on your back?
I was on my back.
Yeah.
And there was two or three doctors behind the forceps. Wow. That head doctor had come in and gave me a really good internal and external feel and said, look, it's a decent-sized baby, but it's not a huge baby. Like, you know, this is you can birth this baby vaginally. You just might need some assistance. So the forceps, he said you would have only had one contraction, like you had one contraction to get that baby out. If they hadn't have worked, it would have gone to a cesarean. So out he came. Very forcefully, but again, he was, he ended up being 3'7", so he was a bit bigger, 3'7", 4'0", than my daughter, but he was straight on my chest, came out crying, apgar of 9, and a bit bruised on his head because of the forceps. Yeah. But I remember that they did the first pull of the forceps, I screamed, and I'm pretty good with pain, so I was pretty good at keeping it together, but I screamed and I said to my husband, I can't do this. And he looked at me and said, the head's already out. You've done it. And I went, oh, okay. Maybe I can do this.
So the forceps was used to get the to help assist his head coming out?
Yeah.
Not his body per se, no, just the head.
Okay. Yeah. And then I don't actually know. That's a good question, whether they're still on them when they get the second, when the body comes out. But I think it was just the head.
Yeah,
I wasn't looking down there.
Yeah, you were in another world right there. You were so focused on getting out and pushing with all your might, so
yes,
you wouldn't need a cesarean.
Like, I remember on the way down to theatre, getting wheeled down, and I was pushing, and I did a poo. And I was like, oh no, I'm so embarrassed. And they're like, no, the midwife's like, this is good. That means he's coming in the right position.
Yeah.
There was some tearing, and they had to do the episiotomy due to get the forceps. So I had a tear and I did have the episiotomy, and it was quite painful sewing me back up straight after having him because I'd only had the impartial
epi, no pain
so
relief.
I still had a lot of healing.
Yeah.
And that's also probably why the forceps were so painful too. But the next day the doctor came to me and said, look, that would have seemed really brutal, but he said, if we hadn't have done that, we wouldn't have got your baby out. He said, you wouldn't have had the feeling to push. So that's why, sorry that it seemed quite harsh, but that's why I made that call. And I said to him, thank you so much.
Yeah. Was they saying that his positioning as well, like, so they required that kind of intervention because of his positioning, because yes, he wasn't going to shift had they waited.
I was 10 centimetres, so it wasn't a matter of dilation. It was, yes, it was his position. That
was he ever in any fetal distress?
He wasn't, but it was interesting. Just as I was preparing for your podcast, I actually read through my birth notes and it said that he had a cord wrapped around his neck once. And I don't remember them telling me that. And I said to my husband, did you know that had happened? He wasn't blue or anything. He came out crying. But, yeah, so that did happen on delivery. Yeah. Just said that it was a
Isn't that interesting? Wrapped around
once. But, so, yeah, it was quite painful when they were sewing me up. So they ended up giving me quite a lot of anaesthetic because I could still feel everything. But amazingly, he was more alert than when my daughter was born, so he breastfed straight away, which was lovely. Skin on skin and really, like, fed straight away, which I turned to my husband and go, this is amazing, he's really alert. And, like, in hindsight, my daughter must have just been quite drugged up from all the drugs in my system, that she was quite sleepy, whereas he was a lot more alert. And we had our big boy. We didn't know it was a boy, so I remember just saying, we got our boy.
Wow.
And I did it, and he looked so big. Lovely. And the nurse was amazing because she said, I said, how much does he weigh? And she said, let's not worry about that. He's where he should be. He's on you. And we didn't actually weigh him. They didn't do all that until we went back up to the birth suites. They didn't even, you know, she said, just let him. He's where he should be. He's feeding with you. Just stay, which was really nice. I thought that was really good advice. Because, you know, often they're so keen to whip them away and measure them and weigh them. And, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask, did you have delayed cord clamping?
I didn't actually know about that, so I didn't know to request that. So, no, and I did have the assisted delivery of the placenta as well.
Your blood loss this time?
I did have not as much. I think I had like 800 mils or something, but there was some blood loss. So they were keen to get it all stitched back up, I think.
How did you go in recovery?
Because it was... I thought, I've had a vaginal birth. I can get up the next day. however, so as soon as the nurse offered, she said, you know, you can get up. I said, yeah, I'll get up. And I sat up and I thought, and I nearly tried to stand up. I thought, maybe I'm just being a bit too keen. I was quite dizzy and nearly fell over. So I'm like, maybe I'll just lie a little bit longer. Because although I'd had a natural birth, it was quite full on. So no. And the first time I did wake up, I actually felt all this liquid going down my legs and I'm like, what's that? Is that waters? And the nurse said, that's actually wee. So I had quite a bit of incontinence because they'd used so much anaesthetic to sew me up. I couldn't really feel any what was going on down there. So that was, I guess, something different.
I wanted to ask you, how has your, like, I guess, long-term recovery been after the episiotomy and the forceps? Yes, because we hear a lot about, I guess, forceps, particularly like with pelvic floor. I'm just interested to know what your experience has been like recovering from that.
It's good because I've had the experience of having both, and I still say that recovery is far better with a VBAC. I got back into exercise at 12 weeks. My goal was to get back into exercise, which I hadn't really between kids as much. Like pre-baby, I was a 5-6 day a week gym junkie. And then I did a little bit with my daughter, but didn't like leaving her in creche at the gym. So I hadn't really, but this time I'm like, I really want to focus on getting fit and healthy again post-bub. So I saw a physio quite early. And that was awesome because actually she told me, she's like, the best thing I can tell you right now, because it was quite early, is rest. She's like, you need to rest even more so than if you've had a cesarean. Because I was like, I can do everything. I can lift things. I've had a vagina birth. She's like, you need to just rest. She looked at me and gave me an assessment that said, I'll see you when you've recovered a bit more. But just at the moment, the best thing I can say is just don't lift anything too heavy. Don't lift anything heavier than... Because I thought, I can lift everything, I can do it all. Because I did still have a few issues with incontinence. So later on I saw her and they gave me all the exercises and I got back into exercise at 12 weeks and have been going to the gym 4 days a week since then. And I feel like got my fitness back a lot sooner than with the cesarean. Because you feel like all your guts are going to fall out when you're exercising after a cesarean. Whereas now I just feel a different discomfort. But yeah, the physio has been amazing. And it's just like anything, you've just got to do the exercises every day.
Yeah. So it's still ongoing for you?
Yes. It is. And I think as my fitness gets better, I push myself harder and then I find it has happened again. So I do. And then I haven't done my pelvic floors every day. I do it when I'll try to get my daughter to sleep because she's quite the toddler. She's quite difficult to get to sleep. And every time I was trying to get her to sleep, I would do my pelvic floors.
Do your exercises.
You're lying there with them.
Yeah.
Because people say, do pelvic floors at the traffic light. But it's actually not like that. If you want to do it properly, you need to be lying down and really focused and doing them properly.
Focusing on the muscles.
Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. And it's good to know. And it's good advice, I guess, from your physio as well, particularly in that early postpartum period to rest. And it's something that I think we don't do that often. We feel like, you know, we've had a vaginal birth. We can do everything now. But
I was so victorious, like, yes, I've done it, so I can do anything.
Yeah.
I think I was just going to say, how did that feeling post-birth obviously compare to your cesarean, like mentally and emotionally, how were you feeling?
I think there's a bit of relief because we're so hard on ourselves, and having listened to all your amazing stories, and I did feel a bit annoyed because I was like, well, it wasn't this amazing drug-free experience that all these ladies talk about, but, you know, I guess it's still a vaginal birth. It still counts, kind of. And I was really happy to hear that when you interviewed some people that didn't achieve their VBAC, because I think that's really important too. And I've since talked to quite a few mums that haven't got it, and that is just devastating. So, you know, it's tough. You can only do what you can do. And I think it's really unfair that for some women they just didn't have that doctor on that was going to be on their side, because had that doctor not been on duty, I wouldn't have achieved it, which is, a little bit unfair, I feel.
That's right. Mm. Yeah, I think with a lot of things in birth, it is that sort of luck of the draw and who your support people are at that time. And so as much of it that as you can control, you can only control so much. And then the world around you is the rest of it. There's so many different factors.
You can't, you do all the exercises, but if you've got another posterior baby, it's not much
about it. Yeah.
Maybe it's just the shape of my hips or my pelvis, or I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even my VBAC wasn't that calm sort of birth experience that we all talk about wanting. And even though it was unmedicated, but it was still in hospital, there were still interventions going on, there were still other things that didn't make it that sort of textbook calm birth, I guess. And yeah, I guess there'll always be those things that you take away from each experience, to, you know, things that were in your control and out of your control, and every birth is different. So
that's right. And at the end of the day, I had two kids that I was able to put on my chest and not leave for the whole time.
Amazing.
He was a bit jaundiced in the end, but he was right on the line. So he was right on the line of needing to go for a top up. So I kept on pushing, no, I'd rather have him with me. And even though I knew more this time, he'd lost 13% of his body weight. So they still pushed formula on me, even though I knew I didn't want it. They weren't going to let me discharge because he'd lost weight. So the same thing, he had a tongue tie as well.
Really? So I was going to ask you about that.
Even though I was more informed this time, I still felt a little bit bullied by the whole weight top up trap. And we're not going to discharge you until he's reached that line, you know.
And so you felt pressure again this time at this particular hospital to sign off on formula feeding, is that it?
Yes. I actually refused it and was pumping. But I was pumping to the point of getting engorged, which that shouldn't happen, because then you're going to create an oversupply. I knew a lot about breastfeeding this time, but there was still, and I remember the nurse telling me, well, the doctor said if you don't top him up, then he's going to need a drip. What's it called? In through his nose?
Oh, yes.
Extra sustenance, tube fed.
Tube fed, okay.
And I said, how can the doctor say that? He's not even coming and met my, haven't even seen my child. They're just looking at the percentages. And I don't know if that's because what they do up here is they try to really feed kids up before they go off to communities as well. They want to really make sure that kids are really well got their birth weight because they're going out remote. So they're just looking at their policy and their numbers. They're not actually looking at the individual. Whereas I was going back to see a dentist, I couldn't actually put the dentist appointment in until I got discharged and they weren't discharging me. So even though I knew more, I was still at the whim of what they were wanting, their number game.
It's pretty hard, but that's good. So how many days, when were you actually discharged? So after giving birth, like how many days did you spend in hospital?
4 nights in the end.
4 nights
maybe
in the
five,
end.
Okay. Yeah. And again, I couldn't sleep. Because it's just so noisy. But yeah. I was just happy to get home. And I just thought, I can't believe this is happening to me again. I'm still feeling bullied about feeding.
But when you came home, how is your daughter Stella like with the reaction?
Well, she was absolutely in love with him. And we had COVID, but we still could have our family visit. So she was able to come and visit him in the hospital. I mean, everyone had COVID, but we had no active cases. So she came and saw him and it was just a beautiful moment. And I remember she was looking at him and we'd bathed him and everything and she was just in love. And the nurse came in and she looked at the nurse and she said, "This is my brother. He's got a penis." And the nurse just cracked up. She just thought it was great.
It's so fascinating. Oh, that's so lovely to hear.
So we wanted to ask you if you have any advice to give other women who are going for VBACs at this time.
My number one thing I would like to tell women and myself is just don't be so hard on yourself. I know we want to achieve this perfect, we all want the perfect birth, but you, like we said, there's only so many things you can control. Yes, you can educate yourself. Yes, you can stay fit and healthy. Yes, you can say yes and no to the decisions along the way, but at the end of the day, it is a little bit of luck of the draw. So, yeah, just cut yourself some slack.
Yeah, great advice. Definitely.
Yeah, that's really good advice. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us. We really, really love chatting to you and hearing about life in Darwin in sunny, hot, humid Darwin.
Which we're very jealous about. I wonder if we're going to have all of these people migrate from the East Coast to Darwin.
It's happening. Our housing market is going crazy at the moment because we've got all these Victorians moving.
Yeah. It's understandable.
I'd just like to thank you, ladies, so much for all the work that you do in this space. I think it really is something that needs more attention and that we need to keep campaigning. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. It's nice to know that it could help in any small way on your journey. And we really appreciate you listening.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC journey. If you like the show, please subscribe, leave us a review, or consider joining our Patreon. We thank you very much for your support.
VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.